This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Jackie Robinson broke many barriers in his lifetime, both on and off the baseball field. Robinson was born in the small town of Cairo, Georgia, but he made international headlines when he joined the Brooklyn Dodgers and became the first African-American in the major leagues.
At his St. Albans, New York home, Brooklyn Dodger Jackie Robinson learns that the sports writers have voted him the most valuable player in the National League. There's a wifely kiss for Jackie, who led the league in batting and stolen bases. Son Jackie Jr. hears the news on his third birthday. The first member of his race to play in the majors makes good in a big way.
A new documentary by filmmaker Ken Burns tells Robinson's story through the lens of those who knew him best. It's a two-part, four-hour film, and it premieres tonight on GPB TV. And Ken Burns joins me on the line. Hi there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
I wonder how different it is to be telling the story of someone for whom those who knew him are still living, like his wife and children and people who played baseball with him, as opposed to the distant past, as you sometimes have done, like the Civil War and others.
You know, Abraham Lincoln said, you use the tools you have. And as filmmakers, and it's very important to know that this is a film by me, but also Sarah Burns and David McMahon, the three of us co-produced and co-directed it, and in fact, Sarah and Dave wrote it. Having Rachel was the greatest gift that we could ever imagine. She's 93 years old. She has all her marbles, and I think some of mine, and I want them back. And she could basically fill in the rest of the story. The outlines of Jackie's life are known pretty well, and unfortunately, he's been sort of smothered in mythology, a kind of syrupy, superficial mythology. And it was important to us to sort of show him for the multidimensional human being that he was, not just the statue out there. And she helps make that happen. So this film is, of course, you know, the portrait of the most important person in the history of baseball and one of the greatest Americans to ever live, an unusual pioneer, as Martin Luther King said, a sit-in-er before sit-ins and a freedom rider before freedom rides. But it's also a multi-generational portrait of an African-American family, something you don't get on media, and a love story. And at the heart of it is the extraordinary, complicated relationship between Jackie and Robinson. And you begin to realize, no Rachel, no him. And, you know, had the great good fortune to interview the president and the first lady. And you could see the kind of parallels between these two couples hurtling through different times and spaces, but who nonetheless are having to break down the same barriers and suffer the same kinds of insults and need to find a refuge at home.
It's interesting you say that, because that was one of my biggest takeaways about how hard it is for trailblazers, how we don't treat them particularly well until after they've gone most of the time. Since we brought up Rachel, let's hear her voice.
We finally took a bus to spring training from Jacksonville on our honeymoon. We went to the back of the bus, and when it got dark, I started to cry, because I had felt my great husband, who had been a fighter and a dignified person, had been reduced by discrimination and by segregation. And he had sort of caved in to what the society wanted in the South.
She talks a lot about all of the things that they went to, and she seems to be still fiercely defensive, not in a negative way,
right.
But a fierce fighter for her husband.
Well, you think about the sadness of now living much more time without Jackie than with him. And it is a powerful love story. And you realize the amount that he had to put up with. And her sense, you know, there's a marvelous moment when Jackie, that first year, begins to refer to things that he did on the field by saying we, meaning her and him. And I think he internalized, as did she, the sense of this partnership. So there's something both bittersweet and sad about her many, many years later, refighting the same fights. But there's something really fierce and strong about a woman still willing to stand by her man in the face of, as you say, the inevitable stuff that happens to pioneers. And when you add a black pigmentation to the face of that pioneer, then you're exponentially in bigger trouble. And that's where Jackie's heroism is made, is that being the first African-American in the modern age to sort of, break down a barrier, you can't even imagine the full extent of the opprobrium that was heaped on him, of the slights and slurs and abuse that he would face.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those slights, because one of the things was really surprising to me. I wanted to go back to his time when he was in the military. And just a warning for listeners, the next clip we'll play contains some offensive language, so be advised and listen with caution. Jackie Robinson was charged with insubordination while in the military after an incident on a military bus when he refused to move to the back. Let's listen.
In his testimony, Jackie admitted that he had threatened a private who had insulted him. "If you ever call me a nigger again, I'll break you in two," he'd said. When asked what the word nigger meant, Robinson said, "My grandmother was a slave, and she said the definition of the word was a low, uncouth person. I don't consider that I am low and uncouth. I do not consider myself a nigger at all."
Now, Robinson was found not guilty of all those charges, but he was obviously very upset just by how the military had treated him. And yet, when he got to baseball, when they were looking for a player that would be able to take the insults he was going to have to take, they chose him despite the fact that he had already shown he would stand up to those kind of things. How was he able to do that?
This is the great, great, great dimension of the Jackie Robinson story. We always like it. And that it's just Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Dodgers, is God. He reaches down like Michelangelo's painting and touches his son, Jesus, Jackie, who turns the other cheek for 3 years. And then everything's happy and African-Americans are fully accepted in the baseball. Well, it doesn't happen that way. And I think it's so interesting that the first African-American who was someone who was defiant, who was feisty, who was competitive, who didn't want to let up, and then had to turn the other cheek, had to take it for a while. And then when he didn't have to do that, he was called uppity. So Jackie, let's just put that in perspective. When he refuses to go to the back of the bus at Fort Hood, Texas in 1944, you're more than a decade before Rosa Parks is going to refuse to give up her seat. 3 years later, when he integrates the major leagues for the first time in the modern era, Martin Luther King is just a junior at Morehouse College. Harry S. Truman hasn't integrated the military. There are no organized sit-ins, unless you include the times that Jackie, as a teenager in Pasadena, California, refused to get up until he was served at a Woolworth's counter. And Brown versus Board of Education hadn't happened. So you begin to understand his preeminent position. But then how lonely that position is. And if you add to that somebody who's competitive and feisty and cannot stand discrimination of any time being asked to put up with it, you begin to understand that this is not just a great story in sports. This is not just a great story in American history with its long and complicated and entangled story of race. This is a human story of the highest magnitude. And I think, you know, you begin to appreciate even more who Jackie Robinson was, not only for what he did, but for what he didn't do.
And you include this great comment from President Obama, in which the president is saying his theory is that he felt Jackie Robinson the entire time knew there was a higher cause and a higher purpose. Let's take a listen.
Part of what I admire about Jackie Robinson is precisely his ability to approach baseball and those first 2 years of integration in ways that were contrary to his character or his fundamental sense of what was right and wrong in service of a larger cause. But that's not something that made sense for him to sustain. He had purchased the right to speak his mind many times over.
So President Obama seems to be referring to the moment at which Branch Rickey let Jackie resist. As far as you know, was that always part of the deal that he would only have to take it for a while?
Yeah, 3 years. One in the minor when he played for the Montreal Royals, which was the Dodgers' number one AAA farm team, and then the two seasons, 47 and 48. And then he was sort of free to be, quote, himself, unquote. And I think the president's actually exactly right and understands it. And you can even think that sometimes the criticisms that people make from the president's own side, or that he didn't do this, he didn't do that, he didn't do that, but he had to actually circumscribe a lot of his action in order to bring along those folks who maybe weren't convinced And certainly we can see by our current kind of poisoned and toxic political climate that there are many of them that he was up to the job. And so I think he felt a great deal of affinity for Jackie. But what he's getting at is that here is somebody who is feisty and competitive, who nevertheless understands the larger picture, the larger goal of what he has to do.
Well, one of the things I love and am so grateful for in this documentary is the same thing that bothered me in 42, which is that it became a movie about a savior white guy who found the right person. And that was more about Branch Rickey's strategy than about Jackie Robinson's strength necessarily. But I did want to play this comment from Red Barber, because another thing that I noticed in your documentary is, regardless of our revisionist history, there actually weren't a huge number of people that among the whites who came forward to really stand up for Jackie Robinson or help him or make it easier for him. Let's hear from Red Barber.
But then I began to realize certain things. One, I had nothing to do about being born white. I could have been born black. And so, therefore, I shouldn't be too proud about the fact that I had a white skin. I hadn't selected it. And suddenly I realized that I was a reporter. I was not Mr. Rickey. I was not Manager DeRosa. I was not any of the ball players. All I would have to do when the black man came to the white Dodgers was simply report what he did on the field.
But that's relatively rare among the people that you spoke to and from the coverage at the time. And it feels to me as though Jackie Robinson ended up being caught between the two worlds, because he couldn't entirely please the white Americans, and he ended up not being completely and totally accepted by the new generation of black Americans.
Yeah, this is the tough story, you know. I mean, Red Barber's from Sanford, Florida, and he's really, frankly, shocked when Branch Rickey tells them he's the play-by-play announcer for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And he has an education, and this is the great dilemma. When Jackie Robinson comes up, if you're a racist Brooklyn Dodger fan, you've got three choices. You can change teams, but Jackie means that African-Americans are going to come into other teams eventually. You can change sports, but Jackie's arrival means that other sports are going to integrate too. Or you can change. And I think a lot of Americans did take door number three. And the Dodgers, you know, Tom Brokaw in our film out in the plains of South Dakota says his whole family just uniformly switched their interest to the Brooklyn Dodgers and followed the underdog Jackie Robinson through all of that. But it is true that as he continued his work and particularly adhered to principles of nonviolence that are similar to Dr. King's, when at the mid and late 60s, many in the African-American community had grown weary and impatient of the slow progress in civil rights despite landmark legislation, and there were more militant people, Jackie ran afoul of them. But this is the inevitable friction that is going to come to any principled person. So much of what we do in our ordinary lives is to try to avoid these rough edges, to try to avoid these kind of confrontations. And we are so lucky that our history is dotted with people who were willing to say, look, I'll carry that. I'll deal with that. We have overemphasized the significance of Branch Rickey. He's still a wonderful person. He's still great and hugely important. But I think it's important that we give Jackie Robinson all the agency he's due. And he's the one who had to hit the ball when somebody's throwing at his head. He's the one who had to field the ball when he knew somebody was sliding in with the spikes up. Baseball's a really difficult sport. Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player in the history of the universe, couldn't hit a buck 80 playing baseball. So, you know, it requires, as the writer George Will says, enormous equipoise. And then add to that, you're the first black person out there, the only black person out there, and people are screaming racial epithets at you and calling you, you know, hey boy, and, you know, come and give me a shine, and putting black cats on the field and threatening to kill you and your wife and your infant son, and are throwing at your head and all of the other things that happened to him, and then still be able to be elected to the Hall of Fame in his first year of eligibility. Now, that's an accomplishment that I think is rare. And let's remember, he may not be the best person to ever play baseball, But as I said before, he's the most important. There is no other sport and no other person in baseball in which his number is retired in all 30 stadiums, and that no one can wear his number except April 15th of every year, the anniversary of his coming up, when absolutely everybody from coaches to managers to every player wears number 42. That just gives you a sense of the power of example. I think we wear the number 42 in solidarity with the things that we do together, the progress when we lock arms that we can do. And it can get you through some of the dark nights of the soul these days to know that there's somebody like Jackie Robinson, like we need him so badly right now. And his example is there. The good thing about history is it never goes away.
I think another thing we have forgotten about Jackie Robinson is just how great an athlete he was. You have Howard Bryant in here. That's not the only way, but Howard Bryant is an analyst for both ESPN and NPR, and he's talking about Jackie's, I mean, he could have gone professional in a number of sports. Let's listen to Howard.
You could make an argument that Jackie Robinson was the greatest athlete in American history. His ability as a basketball player, as a track star, as a baseball player, as a football player. Jackie Robinson could have been a star in every single one of those sports. Not just a good player, but a superstar.
How did we forget that?
Well, it's just pretty spectacular when you actually think about it, is that for a while, baseball was kind of the least of his sports. He was a standout football player in the fall, and he was a great basketball player at UCLA in the winter and track and field in the spring. And, oh, by the way, he also played a mean shortstop and other positions in the infield in baseball. And it's amazing. And also his brother Mac, his older brother Mac, won the silver medal a step behind Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics when Adolf Hitler was trying to prove the superiority of the Aryan white races and who should, shame him, not only Jesse Owens, but Mac Robinson. But unfortunately, when Mac Robinson came back from those 36 Olympics, there was no job to be had. He'd be out sweeping the streets of Pasadena, California with his Olympic jacket on.
So what got left? This is a 4-hour documentary, but even so, I can't even imagine how much material you had. What got left on the cutting room floor?
You know, the cutting room floor, Celeste, is not filled with bad scenes. It's filled with terrifically great scenes. So, the president right now is in Cuba, and he took with him 93-year-old Rachel Robinson and Jackie's only daughter, Sharon. And he did that because Jackie had a celebrated time when he went and played in Cuba and before he joined the majors and had these wonderful experiences. So Rachel was a bridge there. That was something we just, there wasn't enough room, too many notes. So it's not stuff. I live in New Hampshire, and we make maple syrup up here, and it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup, and that's a really good description of how you make documentary films, is you got about a 40-to-1 shooting ratio, so you've got stuff that clearly doesn't work, but you also have wonderful things that you wish you could put in, and so at every stage of his life, there's always another detail, there's always another story, there's always, in the case of Jackie, another mythology to refute, or, some of the apocryphal tales that work their way into being true, and you just want to say, you know what, that actually didn't happen.
Well, that's documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. His new film chronicles the life of baseball great Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson, born in Georgia. It's a 2-part documentary. It'll premiere tonight on GPB TV. Ken, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste, for having me.